Isn't there a shaving blade called Atra? Huh? Now whenever you see that, you can think, in my kingdom. Try out there. That doesn't normally mean in my kingdom, but in this context it does. But it, so you can see, when you see the blades, just think of in my kingdom, Krishna's kingdom. Sutaha. Lamentation. Vietu, let there be. Te, your. Vishalat, by the Shudra. Bhayam, cause of fear. Ma, do not. Rodihi, cry. Amba, mother cow. Bhadram, all good. Te, unto you. Kalhanam, of the envious. Mahi, while I am living. Shastari, the ruler of Sabdur. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O son of Sarabi, you need not lament. You need lament no longer now. There is no need to fear this low-class Shudra. And, O mother cow, as long as I am living as the ruler and subduer of all envious men, there is no cause for you to cry. Everything will be good for you. Purport. Protection of bulls and cows and all other animals can be possible only when there is a state ruled by an executive head like Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit addresses the cow as mother, for he is cultured, a cultured twice-born Kshatriya king. Sarabi is the name of the cows which exist in the spiritual planets and are especially reared by Lord Krishna himself, Sri Krishna himself. As men are made after the form and features of the Supreme Lord, so also the cows are made after the form and features of the Sarabi cows in the spiritual kingdom. In the material world, the human society gives all protection to the human being, but there is no law to protect the descendants of Sarabi, who can give all protection to men by supplying the miracle food, milk. But Maharaj Parikshit and the Pandavas were fully conscious of the importance of the cow and bull, and they were prepared to punish the cow killer and with all chastisement, including death. There has sometimes been agitation for the protection of the cow, but for want of pious executive heads and suitable laws, the cow and the bull are not given protection. The human society should recognize the importance of the cow and bull and thus give all protection to these important animals following the footsteps of Maharaj Pariksit. For protecting the cows and Brahminical culture, the Lord, who is very kind to the cow and the Brahmanas, Go Brahmana Nitaya, will be pleased with us and will bestow upon us real peace. So this important verse tells us about a number of subjects. One is the and main point being brought out here is the necessity of protecting the cow and the bull. Mother and father. We are reminded, mother and father, protect your mother and father. Even in Christianity, one of the Ten Commandments, isn't it, is to give honor to one's parents. So what is the difficulty to understand this? The difficulty is that because of imbecilic, you know, mentality, human beings cannot understand what constitutes mother and father. Mother and father mean who protect and nourish their dependents. And therefore, cows and bulls have the right to be called mothers and fathers. It is only because of the demoniac civilization that we are presently living in that milk is now considered to be injurious to health. It's one thing that they admit that cigarette smoking is injurious to health. It's another that they propagate the nonsense that drinking milk may be dangerous for your health. Well, it's not that milk is dangerous. It's because of all the things which are pumped into the cows, you know, in the name of protecting the human beings from some serious cow diseases, that they fill up the cows with all kinds of poisons, and those poisons enter the milk through the cow's blood. Otherwise, you know, milk is life-giving. Sages used to be able to maintain their life simply on milk alone. And an infant child, for the first 6 months, drinks nothing but its mother's milk. So milk is rightfully called a miracle food. Miracle food means it is a complete food. It can maintain human existence. And the same cannot be said of many other types of foods. So, it is very, very special. And therefore, the mother, the cow, is to be considered very special. And Maharaj Pariksit is a member of an advanced society. And therefore, when he addresses the cow, he doesn't say, "Oh cow," he says, "Oh mother." So much respect. I have seen in India that it is very common in the villages that the first, when they make the chapatis, rolling the chapatis, the first chapatis are fed to the cows. First they offer the chapatis to Krishna, and the first chapatis after being offered to Krishna that are made, and if they, you know, they'll feed the cow. Sometimes they just directly feed the cow. Because namo brahmanya devaya go brahmanya hichaya cha jagat hitaya krishnaya govindaya namo namah. The cows, when the cows eat, when the brahmins eat, it is like Krishna eating. If you feed a brahmin, it's to be considered that Krishna himself is eating. The Krishna eats through the brahmins. Krishna eats through the cows. So in the village society, they have this facility. They can immediately feed the cows. And they do so. And then they feed the human beings. The cow is so sacred. And similarly, the bull. Bull is also considered to be as sacred as the cow. Why? Because the bull does what a father does. Now, bulls are not considered to be useful because of tractors, because of modernization. The tractors have replaced bulls. But tractors cannot do what a bull can do, because tractors just emit what? They emit obnoxious gases which pollute the atmosphere, burn away the ozone covering, and destroy, you know, the earth's surface. But on the other hand, a bull emits, you know, dung. And the dung is perfect fertilizer, which nourishes the earth. So just see the difference. The track, both of them seem to be doing, and people say, oh, tractors are much better than bulls. But the long-range effect of a tractor is to destroy the earth. And the, on the other hand, the bull, short-range and long-range, is simply giving benefit to the earth and its inhabitants. So this is the whole problem with the society we're living in. It is so short-sighted that they are, for some immediate gain, they are willing to take huge long-range losses. This is not a very thoughtful society, not a very loving society. It's like, you know, just immediate Shreyas instead of Shreyas. They want some immediate benefit and not long-range benefit. And everything we see in society today is like that. Gratifying immediately the senses, never mind long-range effect. People are coming up with so many incredible diseases now, and all of these diseases practically could have been avoided. But in order to avoid them, they have to be able to regulate their senses. And this they don't want to do. They want to figure out how to have unlimited sense enjoyment and at the same time not have to pay the consequences. Not have to suffer the consequences. That's not possible. You know, you want one, you get the other with it. So, This Maharaj Parikshit is a Kshatriya. Kshatriya means to give protection. And the difficulty today is there is so little certainty of protection. Now, you know, people have to live in constant fear. Constant fear. Most diseases, they say, are due to anxiety. And people are in a constant state of anxiety. There's so much fearfulness at every moment. A person enters, you know, the world, and there's nothing but threat on every side. Financially, people feel threatened. Physically, people are feeling threatened. Emotionally, people feel threatened. Naturally, on nature's courses, people feel threatened. There's no relief in sight. In every direction, there is threat. But in the Vedic culture, this type of anxiety was unknown. It was unheard of. That's why we read in Krishna book that when the son of a Brahmin died prematurely, he immediately went and complained to the Pandavas. You're supposed to be kings. How could this happen? I didn't do anything wrong. My son didn't do anything wrong. How is it possible, therefore, that my son died? It's not possible. There's no connection. You see? People look for causes. Now, we live in a world where people say there is no real connection. There is no cause. They don't see that the basic point is that ultimately they don't see what the final cause is. What is the final cause? Just like we were studying in this one class about miracles. You know, miracles. It's when you read the Bhagavatam, you see one miracle after another, a Chaitanya Chaitamrita, right? I mean, there's a lot of miracles. Krishna cuts off someone's head, you know, with his hand. Krishna holds up a mountain like Govardhan for 7 days and seven nights. That's a miracle. What is a miracle? A miracle means when nature's laws are defied. Right? Now, nature's laws are defied. Now we know, for example, if someone jumps out a window, what is going to happen? They're going to go downwards, right? If the window's up high, they're going to go down. We know that there's a law called gravity, which is going to pull that person quickly down. Depending on how high he's falling from, the speed could increase, and he's going to crash to his death. On the other hand, we find out that when Krishna and Balaram jumped off a burning mountain, which was how high? 88 miles high. They didn't crash down. They had a nice landing. That means that they defied the laws of nature. Right? So, is this scientific? Now we are living in a scientific age. We get on an airplane, take off from Dallas, Texas, and we expect to land in, you know, wherever we're going, North Carolina, Florida, you know, the South Pacific, wherever we're flying to, we take it for granted that these things will happen. We know that the airplane works by scientific laws, everything. We turn on electricity, we turn on the switch, we expect light. There's so many modern arrangements which have been developed by working with the laws of nature. So it is considered that if we're going to accept this type of thing, then we should apply the same system of laws, you know, in terms of understanding miracles. Now, what would this mean? This would mean the following. I'm just telling you what the religious departments teach nowadays. This is how they explain things about the miracles in, let's say, the Bible. We can apply the same to the Bible time, and they would look upon it the same way. Well, how we see that there are many exceptions, that a miracle means that there is some exception to the laws. Is it possible that there can be exceptions? Now, theologians have dealt with this question at different times in different ways. In the 18th century, when, you know, you had the Enlightenment, when all of the big thinkers started to figure out what was going on in the universe, they came up with what was called deism. Deism means that they accepted that there is a creator, but once God created the universe, he said, see you. He absented himself from the universe, and he let the laws of nature take over. And therefore, everything works by nature's laws, and there's no possibility of anything, any exception to that. So when they read the Bible, they said it's just a bunch of hokey, bunch of nonsense. That's what the, and there's a lot of famous deists in America in the early period of American history. There were many famous deists. Tom Paine was the most famous leader of the deists, and there's so many others. Deism, very popular. Then there's another thing called interventionism. Intervention means that God creates the universe, and from time to time he can intervene whenever there's necessity. So, for example, when you read the miracles in the Bible, those were moments when God intervened. He made exception to the laws of nature, or the Bhagavatam. God is intervening. Krishna held up Govardhan. You know, Krishna did so many things. He intervened on the laws of nature. God can do anything. And then there's another philosophy called immanentism. Immanentism means God is imminent in everything. He's constantly present. And since he's constantly present, how often can he violate or, you know, make exceptions to the laws of nature? Constantly. So, the ancient people, means thousands of years ago, they more or less held to this point of immanentism, that God is always present. And as the religious departments will tell you, you know, they could not distinguish between what was natural and what was supernatural. They made no distinction between what was natural and what was supernatural. They saw the supernatural in every possible circumstance. It's pretty much the way our Bhagavatam speaks, right? At any moment, you know, God can do anything. Great saintly persons can do anything. And then they go further to say that the real point is that they had no real intellectual equipment to be able to judge, you know, critically any reports of any miracles. In other words, they just accepted anything that they heard and didn't really have the intellectual equipment. So, as far as miracle goes, for example, the word miracle doesn't appear in the Bible. It says that, you know, Jesus did a wonder, or he did a great work, or there was some great sign or power from God. But the word miracle doesn't come, because the word didn't exist at that time as that word. It's a modern word to explain when the nature's laws are defied. But people didn't think in the past about it as a defying of nature's laws. They just thought that's natural. They didn't make a distinction between what was miraculous and what was not miraculous. In other words, they saw the miraculous at any moment manifesting. So this is considered to be a delusion. That type of mentality, when you see everybody's sleeping so nicely here. Maybe this is what I need to do, is listen to my lectures. Whenever I want to take rest, I'll just put on one of my lectures and I'll be able to sleep peacefully like everybody else is doing. So this type of mentality, is debunked. In other words, it's considered to be absolutely foolish. Now we have to be critical. We have to see that just as we are very discerning at every moment that, you know, we take advantage of scientific achievements, we should apply the same scientific laws when examining scripture. Well, there are some problems with that. One problem is that problem does not assume really that God exists. Because if God does exist, God can do anything. He can come into this world and he can make exceptions to the laws. Furthermore, there it's not only that God can make exceptions to the laws, but he can empower others to do the same. And just as he empowered some, you know, minuscule scientists to understand a little bit about his powers and his abilities, there's nothing to say that those who are more devoted to him can't be given further understanding. And they can do so many things, like fly, for example, without a spaceship. So we've learned that there are canaries, you know, who are beings who live on higher planets, and they can fly without any spaceship. So I don't see what the difficulty is. Some people can fly by means of a physical contraption, and other people who are more intelligent don't even have to do that. They can just fly on their own strength. I don't see what the problem is. At least it doesn't seem a problem to me. Because probably I don't make any distinction between natural and supernatural, and I lack the intellectual equipment to be critical. Maybe I just... You know, I think I had a discussion with one professor and I made the point that nowadays kids are growing up watching Star Trek and they see these type of things going on all the time. They see different beings from other planets, and I think you'd have a very hard time convincing a kid who's born today that the only place where there's human, where there's life is on the Earth. I don't think any kids will believe that anymore. Because they've seen the contrary on television, which they consider to be, you know, the greatest. You know, that's the real learning place. You know, they just go to school to get entertained, and when they want to come home, that's when they want to learn something, they turn on television. That's really where they do their, you know, big-time learning. So what do they see there? They see all kinds of things. They have these television shows where kids are flying in the air. They have powers, yoga, mystic powers. So, I think anybody who reads our Bhagavatam will say, sure, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. And it's just a question of time until those kids grow up and become the scientists and become the authorities. And, you know, the rules of the game, the way of thinking, the mindset, the take that they have on life is going to change. It's going to change. So, as we were ahead, you know, with our haircuts, so we will be ahead with our thinking. Now kids, you know, realize that this is a very nice hairstyle to have. And similarly, they will, you know, when they'll realize that the Bhagavatam is a very advanced scripture. So, but still, it doesn't mean that we ignore change. One thing that does not change is basic morality. That doesn't change. Just because, you know, people, you see, it becomes very convenient. The change that they make is the kind of change which is total. As they give up their belief in God, they give up also their human morality, their sense of morality, their sense of decency. And so there is no longer respect for the cow and the bull. They are looked upon as useless. The bull has no more use. The cow, you know, also really doesn't have so much value. As soon as she stops giving milk, you know, they feel that they're capable, or they have the right to kill her. And similarly, they have no idea how to give protection. What is the basis of protection? The basis of protection is that there is a certain dignity to every living being. And every living being should be recognized for its intrinsic dignity. But what is the dignity of life? The dignity of life is that we are meant to love God. But the basis of loving God is to recognize our relationship with God. And that is based on not just relating with God, but how we relate with others. So there is a system of authority. There's a system of authority which nowadays has been lost. The king was the authorized leader, the head. There was a head. The Brahmins were heads. The king was the administrative head of society. And people felt that because there was a head, we can get good guidance. We can get proper protection. And people did not feel endangered. Sometimes I get worried even telling someone to go from one house to another nowadays. Early in the morning, I wonder, will something happen, you know? I send somebody over to wake up someone else, and I'm worried that on their way over, will something happen to them? Because there is so much danger. Of course, we are lucky in one sense. We live with so many devotees in the community. There's a little bit more feeling of protection. But we should be very protective. We should be very protective. And we need to, first of all, protect religious principles. The problem is that we don't protect religious principles. Because the beginning of protecting religious principles is to protect principles in your own life. If you don't protect religious principles in your own life, how can you possibly protect them in others? You see, I would come to this point sooner or later, bringing the point home to the individual. There's no use talking about how we're going to function, interact with each other, and how we're going to interact with the world at large until we first of all acknowledge that we have to learn how to properly deal with ourselves. So Srila Prabhupada gave us a formula for how to protect our spiritual lives. And, you know, it is the morning program. Now, this morning there were very few people here at this temple. I was very surprised to note very few people. When we were chanting our rounds, I think there was about 4 people in this temple room. And I was thinking, what are they all doing? Most of the people were sleeping. And I just think, what are they doing? I mean, I can't understand that. If you say, well, I'm very, very, very busy. I think I was much more busy than any of you were in the last few days. But I didn't change my schedule. I didn't change my schedule. I had to study early in the morning. Then I got up at 2:30. I chanted my rounds. I went to Mangal Arati. And then I started studying at 5 o'clock in the morning. But I didn't change my schedule. I got up. I chanted my rounds. I went to the Arati. But I don't see that type of discipline, you know. Rather, I think people just sleep in and, you know, or they adjust their schedules in any this way and that way, stay up late, get up late, or get to bed early and get up late, or something, you know. I don't know what it is. But the result is that you do not protect yourself spiritually. You become weakened. And when you become weakened, then your intelligence becomes lost. You cannot discriminate properly on how to deal with people nicely, how to deal with yourself properly, how to deal with others properly. The whole sense of values becomes distorted. And therefore you can't protect yourself, you can't protect others, and we merge into material existence. You know, as the Bhagavad Gita says in the 2nd chapter, you fall down again into the material whirlpool. So one doesn't have to do that. But the basis is discipline. And discipline, the word, I always say this, the word disciple and discipline, you know, are common. What does a disciple mean? It means that when you say, I am such and such, I'm a disciple of so and so, it means I'm under the disciplinary orders, the instructions of such and such person. That's what it means when you say I have a guru. I'm the disciple of so and so guru means that I am under the disciplinary vows that I have made to my guru and to Krishna. My guru has the right to discipline me. But people don't like to be disciplined. They object to being disciplined. That is the symptom of the Kali Yuga. You know, so that the guru practically has to take out an insurance policy to protect himself from disciples who say, I don't like the way you're disciplining me. Well, then what is the meaning? The whole relationship between guru and disciple becomes lost. That's what we see now in a university. There's no question of guru and disciple. The professors are in fear sometimes of disciplining the students. The students regularly come late to class. They come, you know, they come 30 minutes, 40 minutes into a 50-minute class period, and still have their nerve to go up to the professor, Dan, and say, I'm here. I wasn't absent. Because if you get more than 3 absences in a class, you could be dropped from the class. They have a right to drop you or start dropping your grade. But you never know who the student is. The student may be the son or daughter of such and such member of the Board of Trustees of the university. So that the professors are always in fear of, downgrading someone. What to speak of dropping them? Even though they have good reason to do so. So we would not want our, organization, our society, to turn into such a circumstance as that. And in order to avoid that, we have to discipline ourselves. Because after all, nobody can discipline you really ultimately except you yourself. You have to apply. Well, each day, each time, you make the wrong decision. And as soon as you make the right decision, you get a little more strength to make the next right decision more easily. But when you make a wrong decision, you immediately become weakened so that the next time you have to make a decision, it's a little bit more difficult. Now, if you just take things in incremental, if you make decisions in an incremental way, instead of thinking of the whole, how do I become Krishna conscious? That's a very big question. That's a very big issue. How do I become Krishna conscious? You don't just become Krishna conscious, but if you analyze it, Krishna consciousness can be understood in the incremental steps of each time you have to make a decision to make it correctly. If each time you make a decision and that decision is correct, put the whole thing together, you're becoming Krishna conscious. And that's much easier to deal with. Because if you start to think, how am I going to become, that's an overwhelming thought, how am I going to become a pure devotee? That is an overwhelming task. But, will I come to class today? Well, that's not so difficult. You could handle that decision. Should I get up for Mangal Arati? That you could probably handle that. If you say, should I get up for Mangal Arati every day this week, that becomes very troublesome. You see, you might probably say, I'll turn off the alarm and just turn around. I mean, I practically wanted to do that. I was under so much strain the last few days. I thought this morning, and I got some good rest, but I thought, I could easily rest more. I was mentally exhausted. I thought I could easily rest more. But then immediately what came in my mind, it was about 3:40 in the morning, came in my mind, the Bhagavad Gita verse, a yogi is one who does not eat too much, does not eat too little, does not sleep. You cannot be a yogi, O Arjuna, if you don't practice. And I thought, I got to get up. Somehow I have to get up. And Krishna will somehow, whatever has to be done, I'll keep going. And I was thinking, because that will allow me to be more Krishna conscious. Not that I really thought I probably could have rested another hour, an hour and a half, which is a lot for me to rest that much, but I was so mentally exhausted, but I thought, no, I didn't get up. Krishna says, this is what a yogi is, so be a yogi. Well, I didn't think, I thought for the long run also, but I also thought for the short run, and it was all right. Here I am giving the class. So I think that moment by moment, if we make the right decisions, the overall effect will be there. We will get to the goal. Then we can protect others. If you can protect yourself, then you can protect your family, you can protect friends, you can protect, fellow devotees, you can protect this temple. Now, that should be our business, how to protect ISKCON. That was what Prabhupada's mood was. Not just how to protect my family. I mean, I think that, everyone here does that to a certain degree, and I think that, we should realize our families, don't stop at the doorway. It doesn't stop in the four walls of the house. The family is the community. That is our spiritual family. This is something which every religious discipline, every religious tradition teaches this point. They expand the understanding of family beyond just father, mother, kids, parents, and other relatives, blood relatives, to a spiritual family. So you should be concerned. I think that, after all, what is my relationship? I don't have family relationship here. But my relationship is a spiritual relationship with the devotees in this community. And it doesn't make me feel any less responsible, committed to them. Rather, I think it is deep commitment. And we should not only feel that with guru, We should not just feel that with, you know, a God brother, a God sister, or a God brother, a God sister who I like. We have to feel the connection and relationship with everyone. And the problems of, you know, this community should be our problems. Just like now we have a shortage of pujaris. I don't see a lot of people come forward and really volunteer. I see that there are so many Brahmins in this community who don't do deity worship. And I can't understand how that's possible. I mean, I don't understand that personally. I can't find it very hard to understand. You know, here you have the deities who you all love and you're attached to. But, you know, as far as actually coming forward and doing some deity service, you don't do it. You all have your explanations. Oh, I'm very busy, I'm this, I'm that. But you don't come forward. You have a case like, you know, someone may have to go away for some emergency reason. Well, who will take up their service? And then if you're asked to, you say, oh, I'm really burdened, I can't do it. But I don't think that's the nature of, you know, of feeling responsible. A responsible person takes on more responsibility. A responsible person sees Krishna's hand when asked to do more. Doesn't feel it a burden, but thinks, this is my good fortune. And when we have such a, you know, a good mood like that, then everything becomes joyous. The only thing that stops us from having that right mentality is an enjoying mood. If we're in an enjoying mood. Now, that enjoying mood, people here are pretty much, they have the sense of enjoyment beaten out of them, I would say. In other words, I would say that you have all come to a point, most of you, where you've given up the idea that you can enjoy. But you still haven't given up the idea that you shouldn't suffer. So you come fit halfway around. You've already figured out you can't enjoy. Why? Because first of all, your bodies are getting old. So the possibility of enjoyment is pretty much out of the question. And you've also been, you know, suffering quite a bit. In other words, the material energy has taken its toll. So you've figured out by now life is not for enjoying. But you haven't yet figured out that life is for suffering. But you still think, I can at least avoid suffering. Yeah, all right, I agree I can't enjoy, but I don't want to suffer. You haven't fully surrendered yet. When you fully understand that life is meant for suffering, that this human life is meant, I'm using this word, of course, in a special way, but this is meant for tapasya. Tapasya and suffering have, you know, you can say, what is tapasya? The definition of tapasya is voluntary discomfort, voluntary austerity, voluntary suffering. Voluntary, not forced. People suffer, but it's not tapasya, because they don't want to suffer. But when you want to suffer, when you take on that suffering, then it's called tapasya, and that's spiritually beneficial. So, you know, we've come halfway, and now you have to come to the other halfway. You have to be you have to martyr yourself. You have to be willing to put yourself up for suffering on behalf of Krishna. Then what will happen? You won't experience it as suffering. It's suffering is, after all, a certain type of mentality. It's an attitude. Nothing more than an attitude. As soon as you change the attitude towards suffering, it stops being suffering. So when you're asked to do deity worship, you don't groan. When you're asked to give a class, you won't groan. When you're asked to, you know, do this service or that service, you won't groan. You'll say, thank you, Krishna. Just like the Krishna say, thank you, Jesus. Just say, thank you, Krishna. It's the same mood that you have to think that Krishna is coming to me and offering me this opportunity. You're chanting. I always wonder, people chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Oh, Krishna, oh, Radharani, please engage me in your service. And then, you know, they do, and then you say, no. That's not really what I meant. So that's what you were saying for 2 hours today. You kept saying, you know, you prayed harder for this than anything else, and now here it comes, and you say, no. That doesn't make any sense. Or you may think, well, you know, it's just been a difficult week, but next week. That is, you know, that is really Maya talking next week. That next week will never come. It will never be. The pieces will never fit properly. They have to start to fit right now. You have to understand, this is austerity. This is tapasya. Human life is meant for this. Human life is meant for it. Every living being's life in this material world is for suffering. There is nothing but suffering in this material world, practically. One degree or another of it. The difference is that human beings can understand that when you offer suffering to Krishna as a sacrifice, that suffering becomes joy, bhakti. That's tapasya. That's the only difference between a human being and an animal or other living beings. Every one of them in the material world suffers, but a human being makes advancement through suffering, can at least make advancement, whereas the others simply, you know, go forward in the evolutionary cycle. But a human being can go spiritually forward by immediately understanding this suffering is for Krishna. Now you have to though, evaluate whether what you're doing is for Krishna. And unfortunately, much of our suffering is, you know, self-imposed. It's self-imposed suffering, which is not necessarily spiritually advantageous. But there are some very definite, direct, spiritually advantageous forms of suffering that are available here. We have a whole, you know, choice of them available to anybody in this temple. And you can be sure these are spiritually advantageous. There's no material reward involved. You don't get anything by worshiping a deity materially. You just get spiritual, you know, payment. You do devotional service, you get spiritually rewarded. You don't get material reward. You have to see that what I'm doing, to a great extent, is fruitive very often, especially in household life. That is the damnation, you can say, of a householder life, that so much of what you do is fruitive. You have to just work so hard just to maintain. That's the advantage of a brahmachari life or a brahmacharini life. But you don't have to do that. You're free. You can just do devotional service all day long. Well, in household life, you can't. Not so easily, because you have so many responsibilities. Granted that the more and more you dovetail your family's life in Krishna's service, there's some spiritual, you know, element to everything you do. Accept it. But it's still got some special merit to it when you do pure devotional service activities, where there is no fruitive reward. So there are lists of things which can be taken up. And everyone here does those, but I'm only arguing that, you know, at times like this, when many people are out of town, etc., etc., you may have to do more. And when those times come, you know, communities should, you know, cohere. They should come together. There should be coherence. They should be supportive of each other. Oh, sure, I'll cover your duty. No problem. Maybe I'll just have to sleep less. Or do something else. Or I'll have to economize my time better. But you don't say, no, sorry. Then one day when you need that help, someone's going to say, no, I'm sorry. But again, it all begins with your attitude when you get up or don't get up in the morning. It all starts with that. I think I was mentally as exhausted as anybody could be. Only Radhavinod could have been as exhausted as I was. And that was self-induced. Mine could also be said to be self-induced. I would say he was the only person who could be possibly mentally exhausted. But I got up. I got up. My alarm, I have a nice, you know, little talking alarm that's been talking to me for how long, Duresha? Well, it's at least 14 or 15 years. This little Japanese voice comes on. It's, you know, such and such time. Time to get up. Yeah, I can't figure out if it's a male voice, a female voice. Something from Japan tells me to get up. Then if you don't get up, it's even worse. After 5 minutes, what does it say? It's getting late now. It says, shut up. Doesn't stop. And I always put it far enough away that I can't reach it. Got to get up, turn that thing off. In fact, I can't stand that voice to the point where I usually wake up about a minute before it goes off. Just so I don't have to hear it. So you have to find such an obnoxious alarm clock, you know, that you just can't ignore it. Not that you find some really sweet chime. It's just, you know, you think you're in heaven. I had such an unusual dream last night. I dreamt about it. I was with Gary Dornemars, and I was dreaming about, I was telling him about another dream that I remember what it was. It was a very wild dream. I mean, I was telling him that I was dreaming that I was, and in the dream I was telling him that I had just had this dream the day before. It was pretty unusual. I told him, you know, I was describing the heart. It's amazing how, just see how the mind works. I was in a dream, and I was telling him about, you know, as if I was awake, right? And it was, you know, that you can't, I just, it's amazing, this very thing that we're living through right now. I just had this dream the day before, but actually it was a dream. Dream within a dream. Very interesting how the mind works. So, you know, there's plenty of time for dreaming. You get 6-7 hours every night. You don't have to dream more than that. People should not dream when they're awake. Now, this is not a dream. And I was telling him about, you know, as if I was awake, right? And it was, you know, that you can't, I just, it's amazing, this very thing that we're living through right now. I just had this dream the day before, but actually it was a dream. Dream within a dream. Very interesting how the mind works. So, you know, there's plenty of time for dreaming. You get 6-7 hours every night. You don't have to dream more than that. People should not dream when they're awake. Now, this is not a dream. We can say that the materialists are part of Maya's dream. But the devotees have woken up. Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, Gaura Chandra Gaura. Now we have woken up from the, you know, sleeping in the lap of the witch called Maya. Now we are awake. We are serving Krishna. So let us use this life. Let us dedicate this life fully and wholly for Krishna's service. Try to push yourself more. You can. Everybody here can improve. There is room for improvement. And make the improvement by incremental steps. Don't try to become a pure devotee, you know, immediately. Just try to get up. Make that your vow. Let me get up for Mangal Arati. Let me come to the temple to chant my japa. Let me do some deity worship. Let me do some community service. Let me do more. If I'm doing that, let me do more. And if I feel that it's, you know, a burden, let me understand. The burden is that I've come in this material world. The burden is that I have a material body. This is not a burden. This is how I'm getting rid of all of the problems, by doing service to Krishna. John, any questions? Yes, Chaitanya Chandra. Speaking about protection, that's quite a nice fence you put up there. Are you planning to, are you going to cut like notches at the top, or is it going to always look like a fort? At least you stained it. Now that you stained it, it looks quite nice. I have to get darshan of that fence every day when I go off to school. So just wanted to express my admiration for your new fence. You're not going to put barbed wire on top of it. Little machine gun turret. Yes, speaking of protection. What was your question?
As far as protecting the devotees, there's so many different, like for instance, on the computer, no. So many negative things that
true.
You're responsible for. Right, so if you see something like that,
My suggestion would be that if you're on a computer, and if you know you get all this kind of garbage, irresponsible, negative garbage, that you immediately forward it to our devotees in Houston. What's that guy's name in Houston?
Vijay Pai.
Vijay Pai, who is like an expert machine gunnist, that destroys anybody in sight who does any blasphemy. You know, he's like, you know, he's a declared and avowed enemy of any nonsense people on the internet. So if you need his address, I can give it to you. And all you have to do is forward the latest garbage to him, and he will destroy them. He's just set for that. He takes pleasure in it. He's very expert with the computer. And, you know, it's just like feeding him. It's like feeding a tiger when you give him stuff like this. He immediately chews it up. And he's probably already got it and dealt with it. And he can just send you his response so that you can get purified from the contamination of having read it. Also, you have to understand that, you know, some people attract this kind of stuff. Like, I generally don't get this stuff. People know it's a waste of time. They don't send me that kind of pollution. So, you know, the only thing you might want to respond is just let you know that I'm not even bothering. Anytime I see anything from you, I'm immediately going to delete it. So if you want to just keep wasting money, go ahead and do it. I'm not reading it anymore. Which is a fact. They have to pay for it when they send it out. Kartikeya. Does that fit in with the, what do they call them? Pretty good. I didn't even get it from anyone, but I just thought it up, sitting in front of Radha Kaunda. Huh?
They call it this light edge, and it's this subtotal of all your lead positions that today doesn't seem to make a difference. Now, in 5 years, we put you in a whole different place.
Boy, I could be making a lot of money with these speeches. Yeah, I almost fell in that trap this morning. They tried to serve me breakfast without my apple. But I immediately, yeah, that, come to mommy, I said, where's my apple? Right? I agree with that. You got to eat an apple every day. That's the point you're making. Yeah, a little bit. A little bit makes a difference. Drops of water wear away the stone. Drops of water. How can water wear away a stone? It's impossible. Water is soft, the stone is hard. But if this water drops in the same point day after day, eventually it'll cut right through the stone. So you just do a little bit of devotional service properly done day after day after day, it'll take you right back to God. Yes, Rasa,
we can see, especially in Christian tradition, especially in Dallas, Jesus is healing the sick, or Jesus is making the poor rich. What can we make out of that? Because we seem to give a lot of weight for miracles in that tradition.
That Jesus is making people rich?
Yeah.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it's Jesus making them rich, because in the Bible it says it's more difficult for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. So I don't believe it. I don't believe that that's Jesus working. I believe it's the opposite of Jesus who's working there. It's the enemies of Jesus who are working. I don't believe it. I'll believe it when I see that a rich person devotes their wealth in the service of God, then I'll believe that God gave them that money. But if all that happens after they get rich is that they use that money for more and more sinful behavior, how can we ever think that God is so thoughtless that he gave this person so much money and that the money was used in such sinful ways? Is God so foolish a parent? If God is a father, I don't believe. I don't believe it's God who gave him the money. It was the devil, according to the Christians. Ladies, have questions? So submissive. If only that were so.
Okay,
sir. Yes, rather, you know.
Again, on this point, I think one of the most, our miracles are more humanitarian, or our miracles are more like lead us to Krishna.
No. Well, yeah, I see your point. Yeah, that's true. But miracles are, you know, to relieve the suffering. There's four types of miracles that you read about in the Gospels. The first type are called healing miracles. There's three types of healing miracles. There are miracles which Jesus cures diseases. There are miracles in which he exorcises demons. And there are miracles where he resuscitates the dead. And then there are natural miracles where he does some extraordinary thing on an inanimate object, like, you know, a fig tree doesn't produce figs or can produce figs, or he walks on water, things like that. Four types of miracles. And, you could say that they're not so intertwined with his pastimes. That's so. But, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did a lot of miracles. He did healing miracles. He did, actually, if you think about it, he did all three. All four types. He cured people who were lepers. That's healing the ill. He exorcised demons. There were cases where people were ghostly haunted and other things. We see. And he resuscitated the dead, just like he brought back Srivastava's son to speak. He did the same things. He also delivered the tall trees, palm trees in South India.
Made a mango
grow into it. So we see the same. Not so different. Sorry. Yes. If it actually seems what? The problem is that if people have desires which cannot be checked, you see, you have to consider that each person has a particular. If it actually seems what? The problem is that if people have desires which cannot be checked, you see, you have to consider that each person has a particular illness, and an expert physician knows how to cure that illness. If a person is ill, if they're so smart, why do they get ill? Therefore, we need a physician. So someone is in the material world and they get a guru. The purpose of having a guru is so that the guru can tell you what you need to get better. So you cannot say that, don't give me that medicine, give me the medicine you gave so-and-so. That's fine if you had the same disease. If you don't, you don't get the same medicine. That's what you have to see. You have to see that the medicine, you know, you have to have faith in the physician. If you have faith in the physician, you'll have faith in his medicine. If you have faith in guru, then you'll have faith in his recommendation. Yes. Yes, brahmachari grihastha. That's your answer. Now you get to your answer. Good, thank you. By your question, you answered her question. The answer to her question should be that, very good, you want to be a brahmachari, and if your guru says, or if, you know, if you have to be married, then be a brahmachari grihastha. What is a brahmachari grihastha? It's stated right in Prabhupada's books. If a husband and wife strictly follow the principle of no illicit sex life, and if their entire energy is used in the service of Krishna, they're called brahmachari or brahmacharini grihastha, and there's no difference. There it is, right from scripture. All right, I want to be a brahmachari sannyasi. I have my work to do, and it's getting late. I already got my breakfast, I already took my rest, and I'm ready to go to work. Jai. Sri Sri Radhakala Chanji Ki. Srila Prabhupada Ki. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki. Gaur Premanandi. Jai.